Support for the BTPM NPR What's Next podcast comes from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, partnering with the community to pursue racial and socioeconomic health equity. Learn more at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
absolutely,
if we're uncomfortable
absolutely
talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Welcome to What's Next. I'm executive producer Charles Gilbert. This year, BTPM brought listeners Truth Be Told, a 12-part podcast series designed to explore the lasting effects of systemic racism throughout Western New York. Hosted by Will Green, each episode explored racial inequities across the lifespan, from birth to legacy. On today's show, we highlight four standout conversations from the series through archival moments and continued discussion with Will and the expert featured on that episode. First, Truth Be Told explored the reality surrounding Black maternal health and the importance of being seen, heard, and supported during some of life's most vulnerable moments with Shayna Broughton, founder of Our Mommy's Village.
I could hear her screaming that, I want my sister. And she's like being wheeled down the hallway. And I'm just like, you're not going to get far. She will hold this baby in forever. Like, I don't think you understand.
So, of course, your sister's 17. She's afraid. I'm sure you're afraid, too. But what was the experience like in the hospital? Because, I mean, I'll be honest with you. I know Olean a little bit. It does not look like Buffalo.
97% white.
Right. So, what was that experience like navigating that system in the hospital? And did you notice anything about the treatment your sister was receiving that compelled you to
be
go hard?
Yeah,
like,
I went to her prenatal visits with her, and I made sure that I understood what was happening at every step, because I hadn't had babies. You know what I mean? Like, I knew I wanted them, but I didn't have them. So I felt more comfortable walking into the room knowing that I knew some of the faces that were in there. And she was treated well on the surface, you know what I mean? Like, but what I didn't realize was hindsight. She probably shouldn't have gotten a C-section. But
research shows Black women are almost 25% more likely to have unnecessary C-sections, needlessly putting them at risk. And this disparity appears to stem from provider biases, not medical factors.
That was Will Green and Shayna Broughton, founder of Our Mommy's Village. Now, What's Next contributor Naila Ansari-Cotillo sits with the two to discuss the challenges faced by Black mothers, including the trauma of the events of May 14th and the systemic failures in healthcare. They also discuss the importance of doulas in supporting mothers' mental well-being and the need for community-based solutions.
I'm going to start actually with you, Will, because you do the Truth Be Told. So you're talking about the systems on a deep level. We'll make sure we link to that so y'all can get all the conversations on that. So, Will, you can give us a little intro to yourself, and then let's go in a little bit to, you know, have these systems change since the laugh tells it all. But
I'm born and raised in Buffalo, New York, on the east side of Buffalo. I tell the joke all the time, like, I must have moved 8 times and never left the east side of Buffalo. So that tells you a lot about just the lines of separation and segregation set up in Buffalo. It was really an honor to host the podcast series, Truth Be Told, to meet individuals like Shayna, to hear stories from folks from Buffalo, New York, who really, you know, we just share our story, and then we're able to point out how systemic racism, white supremacy has kind of impacted and created these obstacles that a lot of folks are just familiar with just from living in Buffalo. But we wanted to focus on the triumph and not just the obstacles. So I think Shayna's story about how she became a doula and Our Mommy Village and the work that she's doing now was really a great way to kick off Truth Be Told.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of what we're dealing with now with the anniversary of, you know, the tragedy of 514, certainly there are mixed feelings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we know that I can't even say a lot of work needs to be done. A lot of systems need to be demolished and rebuilt in order for us to deal with how do we get to a place where someone can come into a community and just take people away from us? How do we get to a place when the things that are erected afterwards don't seem to be positively impacting those closest to the tragedy? To me, it is about power, mm-hmm. right? We need to have the power to defend ourselves, protect ourselves, and to deal with trauma in a way that is healthy, not for everybody else, but for the people most directly impacted.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because, Shayna, I'll let you introduce yourself and all the work that the amazing work you've been doing that I can attest to as a mm-hmm. as a mommy to be. It's really domestic terrorism. We don't talk about it like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not prepared for that. In this right. country, period.
Mm-hmm.
So let alone in our communities, people, there is, you know, there's, I know my mom says this all the time, we never had a game plan for this. And so when it happens, it's like, oh yeah, we have racism. But on the extreme level of what that is because to your point, well, like these systems have allowed it to exist. Like mm-hmm. we're still in court. Like, you know what I mean? Like this still hasn't actually been
right.
resolved really.
Right.
Like, you know what I mean? Like we're just picking juries out. Like this is, you know, we talk about the judicial system, like how is that even still
right.
possible and still happening? So Shayna, you're on the, I mean, you do grieving, right? Because a lot of people just think of birth as if there's not grief in that system as well. How have you been managing the birth of Black mothers in a system and this kind of, you know, rebirth of what's come from 514? Yeah.
Well, I still had to manage even before 514. So a lot of the work that I do is very much always rooted in making sure that the mom is okay and that she's safe. However, we had issues before that. So 514 was just another trauma on top of what we were already dealing with. Mothers don't have what they need right now, right this second. So 514 was, it happened. It was just one more thing I had to make sure that moms were okay with because, you know, like I was serving, I think, 10 moms at the same time around 514 when it did happen. We used that grocery store. It was very, very devastating for everybody. But on top of that, you know, we had the tragedy of 514, but then we're being beat down in the systems in the hospital and doctors are not listening to mothers. So it's one more thing that we are now rupturing. There's more happening now than it was before. And for me, it's hard for me to really just kind of go really into it because 514 happened, but I still had so much that I was already dealing with. So it was very difficult for me to handle that. I had to do it individually. Like it was just something I couldn't, you know, like it was just so much. But each mother at that time, they were all shooken up so much that we all just came together and cried about it. There was really not much we could do, but we were already struggling before that. So it was a very difficult situation. And we found that it was very important for us to just kind of hang out with each other. Like, so everything that was happening on the outside, we didn't necessarily know. We were just kind of together.
Well, when we talk about these systems, because you're navigating multiple systems, like there's a healthcare system, and then also being on the east side and just dealing with the political systems
yeah.
of that is really difficult. What's the importance of storytelling? Like you have Truth Be Told, which is mm-hmm. kind of the stories. What's the importance of storytelling so people can really understand how these systems function?
So the importance of storytelling, I think it just goes back to, you know, the griots mm-hmm. and this historical sharing of commonality, right? Because when we tell stories, there are things that the listener can automatically connect to and feel familiar with, right? So when we share the story of Shayna's experience in the doulas, not only, like you said, this kind of bleeds into all these other areas. So not only do you get the experience of what it's like to bring life into the world, but you get the experience of what it's like to be pregnant mm-hmm. and be in a system that treats you like an other, right? And I know that that story is familiar to a lot of people, especially women of color. So I think right after we put the podcast out, there was that viral video of this woman in the emergency room.
Oh, that was
disgusting.
Sick.
Yeah.
Being questioned about health insurance or something while she's in labor. And it's like, oh, we just filmed this podcast, and this isn't like, that's how randomly opportunistic these things happen. It's like, we just did a podcast. Now here you see the visual interpretation of the experience. Mm-hmm. And so many people, oh, that's terrible. That's terrible. But what about the folks who go in and it's not that egregious? Mm-hmm. It's the microaggressions of being talked down to, being isolated, not being heard, right? So folks want to hear these stories because they can connect, but it also opens up the world for us to understand that these things happen on different levels. When we talk about 514, that's an extreme situation. But what are the everyday incidents that contribute to the mentality of othering people, stripping them of their humanity, and you decide to take them out?
Because you don't have 514 without having these systems that have been in place functioning within these microaggressions to allow, right? Mm-hmm. Like every action has, you know, a reaction to it. And so you've allowed all these actions of really misery, racism, white supremacy, you know, add to the list that allow 514 to happen. And I know, Shana, you have a doula cohort training program. You're in the middle of a cohort right now. Mm-hmm. And what's the importance? I mean, I guess you could also explain what is a doula, because some folks, I think we have to start there because the assumption is everybody kind of knows what a doula is. But I actually think a lot of people don't really understand. What is a doula?
All right. So I am a doula and I catch the mom. So anything that has to do with like her mental well-being while she's preparing to have her baby. I'm not any medical nothing, but I am a coach to her. So as she is preparing to have her baby, she's going to have questions. She's going to possibly need me to reassure her repeatedly. As things are getting closer, like preparing for what postpartum looks like, breastfeeding, any of those things, I am a full spectrum doula. So I am all the way from the beginning all the way to the end. So what I do is opposite of what the maybe midwife or doctor would do. They do all of the medical stuff. I am strictly coaching, talking, reassuring, that kind of stuff.
Which is great because most people don't understand that the mom needs support too. It often just seems like it's just the baby, deliver the baby, and that's it. But you need to have the mom in the right state of mind.
Yes.
Because you're bringing that child into
and your
the world.
If you actually, as a mother, you have any kind of mental block, or if you're feeling fear of anything, you could actually delay your process. You'll end up, you know, like, there's certain things that you have to kind of adjust your sail a little bit so that you can actually welcome your baby, because sometimes fear will have you in a C-section real quick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's a lot of conversation that we have about, like, you know, being prepared, but also not being afraid. And that's really difficult to do in a system that really pretty much makes you scared all the time.
So I have another question. This is for both of you to answer. If we got this right, the support, the systems, and our storytelling, what would be different a year from now?
We wouldn't be so reliant on other resources. We would know how to keep ourselves together. Building a system that really doesn't rely on outside support from, like, those folks who are thinking that it's a party, let's plan a celebration. We now know that mental wellness is at the top of the list, and having a food apartheid is not necessary. We know how to sustain ourselves. A year from now.
Yeah, I'm in agreement. I mean, that was a heck of a question. Because I think
loaded, you, I know.
Seriously. Well, in the past, I think we would say, well, these systems would welcome us and they would give us the things that we need to do well while we're in those spaces. I think now, looking at the current state of things in the United States, we're literally, you know, rights and laws are being stripped away that people have fought, bled, and died for, written away with a pen stroke. What I would say is, what I'm talking about in terms of a year from now, if it's what we needed, it is bulletproof. It can't be stripped away. It can't be written away. No one can take it from us. We have complete ownership, and we really are the ones providing the direction about where it goes. Meaning that if we are talking about the birthing of the next generation of Black and brown folks, then we have people like Shayna at the forefront, making the decisions and guiding those with the technical expertise to listen to what she has to say about what it needs to look like when we bring that life into this realm of existence.
Access to higher education can open doors, create opportunity. Truth Be Told spoke with Sherman Webb Middlebrooks as he reflects on the advice and support that helped shape his college journey, while highlighting the importance of mentorship and culturally responsive support systems for Black students navigating higher education.
My brother, he was expecting my oldest nephew to be born, and he left his apartment to his best friend who just came back to New York City, from New York City, and like he's like my big brother too. And he the only person out my brother's crew and generation from the projects that went to college. So I just remember him telling me in one of his moments of being like, yo, little bro, like, I don't care what you do. When you do your application, just check the EOP box, yo. Just check the EOP box. I'm like, all right. I'm doing my application for Duville on my PlayStation 3 halftime of a Bills game. So I'm doing my application, and I scroll down. I'm like, H-E-O-P? That looked like the EOP box. Ford told me to check. Click it.
First-generation students like Sherman make up more than half of all U.S. undergraduates, but they're far more likely to face food insecurity, work long hours, and graduate at lower rates. For many, programs like HEOP are the bridge between potential and possibility.
I started getting letters from a wonderful lady by the name of Deirdre Green. Every letter she sent from Duva had a smiley face on it. So it made me feel like they wanted me there.
Right.
So my only options was Potsdam, which is where Big Bro went, mm-hmm. who told me to check the EOP box.
Right.
Potsdam or Duville, that was it, or the block. Those mm-hmm. those are my options. And so Potsdam was only boasting a 6-screen movie theater. That was like the best thing they had to offer. And Duville was on the west side, a 10-minute bus ride from the hood, so I picked Duville.
Research shows that Black students with consistent mentors are twice as likely to complete college. Programs that employ culturally responsive staff, especially women like Deirdre, help transform campuses into places of belonging.
That was Will Green with Sherman Webb Middlebrooks. Now, Jay Moran sits with both to continue conversation around access, mentorship, and the impact of systemic racism.
As you can reflect now, Will, on this episode with Sherman, what stands out to you now, looking back, and what maybe you took from that particular conversation?
Well, I think the first thing that struck me was just how familiar I was with Sherman's story mm-hmm. and that experience of transition from Buffalo, New York to the college environment. And I went to, you know, college in the Southern Tier, Alfred University. Sherman was in college here, mm-hmm. but it's almost like you're still stepping into a completely different world with different cultural norms. And I think what I've ruminated on a lot is the extreme differences in what you learn in terms of survival and thriving in our community mm-hmm. and what you have to kind of push away to the side to learn survival on a college campus. They're two very different things.
Yeah, that's what the show is really about, or a good portion is just your, I'll use the word survival to start,
yeah,
and then thriving in the college community as well. Would you agree with that assessment?
I think that's a very accurate assessment of the situation, because I tell people, like, I was an HEOP student, so they give you 10 semesters, which is 5 years. I needed all 10 semesters because I spent the first 2 semesters learning how to do college. Mm. Like, the work really wasn't the issue. I just needed to, like, feel comfortable. And the one thing that, like, as I reflect on that episode and I continue to have conversations with people, just not only that transition from like high school to college or from figuring stuff out on my own, no matter where you go or what you're doing, when you're embarking on something, you got to find your people. It's that proverb, if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together. And so it took me about a year to find my people, people that I could trust, people that were reliable, people who were consistent to be able to
you know, have my tribe to help me navigate my way through. It took me that long to find those folks.
Yeah, and of course, it's all documented in the episode, and you can listen to it yourself, Truth Be Told. You can find that, of course, where you find your podcasts. But as a, I guess, you ended up on a list at college like I ended up at my college my first my first year, where that was like, if you have another semester like this, you're gone.
Right.
So take us through both getting that kind of note. I know what it felt like to me. I can't show this to my mother, I think is what my first thought was. But then the second part is then overcoming that.
Yeah. So I think the main thing was like proving a lot of people right. So I've had so many people just believe in me as a young person, even when I didn't believe in myself, from teachers to mentors, social workers, folks in my family. And so when I was in school, I was on academic probation in my major, and I was in academic probation in general. And I remember, God bless her soul, Dr. Patricia Abbott, she reminded me that, like, you really didn't have the qualifications to get in here. I stuck my neck out for you because you wrote a great personal statement. Don't make me look bad. So that kind of got me on track in my major, not wanting to disappoint Dr. Abbott, because she did stick her neck out. And then she did say, this young person has the potential. I want to prove her right. And then I remember having a conversation with my big brother, who went to Alfred. He went out there with a meal plan and lasted like 2 weeks. Well, he's technically my cousin, but he's like my big brother.
Sure.
And he went out there with a meal plan because nobody knew how to fill out his paperwork. So he came back. He didn't finish a semester. And I remember telling him that I was on probation in the major and in school, and we were just sitting in the house, and this is my hero. And he said, so they paying for your books, they paying for your tuition, they paying for your dorm, they giving you a bus pass, and they giving you money, and you messing, he ain't say messing, and you messing up. And he looked at me, he got up, he walked out the room, and then it was the conversation was over. And that was the first time I ever disappointed him. And I realized, like, I'm the one with the chance. I'm the one that everybody's looking at, like, yo, you about to go to college, bro. Like, make it. And I was in there playing. So it was those two moments of, like, I want to prove these people right who believe in me, that really woke me up to start applying myself more. I kind of was afraid of success, too, because I know a lot of people don't want to admit it, but success comes with responsibility and expectations. And, like, once you have success, people expect you to do that consistently. And so a little bit of that for me was a little fear of success and the expectations that come with it. But again, once I found my footing, the people who were encouraging me were also there to support me through. So that's really like the long and short of kind of like what woke me up, those two moments, not wanting to disappoint those two people in particular.
You know, Will, while Sherman was talking, I saw you nodding your head to a lot of his things. So some impressions and thoughts that you want to maybe build on that, what he was mentioning.
Yeah, absolutely. I think number one, you know, you need that support system. You need a support system. Also, it was interesting because the support system for Sherman kind of kicked off that intrinsic motivation of, oh, wait a minute, they are expecting this of me. And he had what he needed on the inside to do it, right? So there's the motivation of the village behind you offering that support, and then you accepting that responsibility and then using what you have inside of you to achieve. I think what's interesting, and this is something that carried through a lot of the conversations in Truth Be Told, because, you know, we wanted to highlight the impact of systemic racism. A lot of times we don't know how this silent system is suppressing us or preventing us from achieving our potential. And you need outside forces to awaken something inside of you to overcome those mental blocks. Like, we can talk about personal responsibility, but one of the things I often refer to is, like, why is it so easy for certain individuals who look a certain way to fall into the myriad pitfalls and traps that are set up, yet so difficult to find that one or two or three guiding lights to initiate that spark that says, okay, no matter what, I'm going to accomplish these goals. That's the piece that I think people should understand, is like, well, the odds are not necessarily in some folks' favor, right? You could just go about your life and you'll end up in certain conditions if you don't take that action, right? But when you do have a village, when you do have people who say, no, this is an opportunity for you, and you can accepted, even though that doctor said, yeah, we let you come in because you didn't necessarily have the credentials. That's what EOP is about.
Exactly.
It's about understanding, like, there's a reason why this individual doesn't look like a quality student on paper. And then when you do go through that fire and when you achieve those goals, it proves everything wrong about why you weren't there and everything right about what we feel about a system that negates certain individuals.
And one of the things that you brought up, I think it was Sherman in the conversation, I want to make sure I have my notes right here in front of me, but that students of color, they succeed at twice the level with consistent mentoring.
Yeah.
You, once you kind of made that turn, you found that.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, that was, I remember again when my mentor, Tracy McGee, my first mentor, because like I got a lot of uncles, family members. So in my mind, like, not to take it for granted, I love my family, everybody listening. I don't disregard y'all, but like, I kind of, to my mind, like, yeah, y'all supposed to love me. Y'all supposed to care about me. You're my uncle. you're my cousin. You're my mom. Like, duh. But why do you care about me? You don't know me. You a mentor. You somebody from school. You a coach. You a somebody from the community. You from my program. Why you care about me? Like, what's special about me? It's other people just like me. Why you care about me? And then them believing in me until I believed in myself, until I was able to see, but them not giving up on me. I think that also was key too, because talking about mentorship, having been a mentee and offering mentorship, is like, it's going to move at its own pace. And so I can't force or want somebody to be in a position mentally or socially that I want them to be in because I care about them. I have to work with them where they're at. And so I presented a lot of challenges to my mentor. So they had to come to court dates. they had to counsel me through hospital visits. They had to counsel me through relationships and different kinds of things to allow me to stay focused on the main thing, because I had so many different things going on in my life that could have been barriers to my academic success. So helping me navigate through life, not only as a young man, so I could stay focused on the main thing, which is getting this degree or getting my education. So just having people that's going to be there for you as a person, man, that I think was one of the benefits of being a psychology student. I took advantage of the fact that I'm like, well, I got a bunch of psychologists and psychiatrists. I got personal issues, my tuition, payday, salary. Let me sit down in your office hours and tell you about my life. Because this is why my paper is late. Because I think I got somebody pregnant and I'm stressed out right now. And guess what I just found out? Drinking feel good. I didn't really drink all like that until I got here. And I'm stressed out. And this is now the thing that I'm doing to get away is starting to get in the way. Can I talk to you about this? Because this is why my grades are slipping. And thank God I had people like Dr. Wallerwander, Dr. Abbott, Dr. Walter at Duville, where I went for undergrad. Thank God I had D and Bev to support me and help that I could be vulnerable and honest with. Hey, you say you believe in me. Well, this is what you believe in. Like, I ain't just the charming, charismatic young man that might come in here and crack a joke. Like, I'm going through stuff, and this is why my grades are slipping. Are you still going to be there for me when it's not easy, when it's not convenient for you? And the fact that people didn't abandon me, like, kind of was like, oh, this ain't performative. They not just doing their job. They really care about me as a person beyond the paycheck. And not only did that impact me as a young person, that also impacts how I show up as young people, for young people now, as an adult who's now in a position to offer mentorship and guidance. I have to do what I know they did that worked for me and be there for them, even when it's not shiny and pretty and convenient.
Something that weighed heavily on me, you know, after the individual conversations and after the completion of the project, was the toll on the people we interviewed and how they had to go back and dig into, pull up some emotions that were quite powerful. I mean, I would talk to individuals afterwards and they say, man, once I left there, I went and had a conversation with this person and I cried. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I think that's what folks need to understand. Like, there is a toll for these experiences. And we wanted to focus on the triumphant component. But to even retell the stories, and even if we focus on how people persevered, there's still a toll that people have to pay as a result of those experiences.
Homeownership has been long connected to opportunity, stability, and generational wealth.
Truth Be Told explored how lending practices and modern algorithms can continue to reinforce longstanding inequities in housing and home ownership with Wiley and Nigeri Hughes.
I get a mortgage broker in Orchard Park, and he basically says, yeah, we'll see what we can do, no problem. What's your income? I give him all the information. And he's like, yeah, this is great, let's go. And then he comes back and says, we can't.
We can't get
we can't you give anything. You a loan because the algorithm won't let me.
And your credit score is very low in your
actually,
algorithm.
He didn't say that initially. He just said, the algorithm won't let me give you a loan. And I said, I don't understand what you mean. He said, well, we give loans based on algorithms, and the algorithm is comprised of all of these metrics, your income, your debt to income ratio, things that I had never heard before.
What's the debt to income ratio?
Credit history, not credit score, credit history. How long have you had credit? I'm like, when did this happen? So the goalpost was moved again. We had a colleague in the church who does business with that individual, and he cursed him out and was like, hey, this is my pastor. What do you mean you can't give him a loan? We know people that you've given loans to, they don't have a dime to their name.
Right.
So you better give him something or we'll quit. I mean, he was adamant. So then the guy brought me back in and was like, we can get you a loan. But the loan was like 200 something thousand. What?
250, I think.
Like 250.
But in Florida, it would have been approved for 400,000.
Yeah. So.
And that was at a time when your credit score was lower.
It was even Thank lower.
You.
Right?
And you had less income.
And we had less income.
Oh, yeah.
I mean?
And then they said, we can't give you a VA loan at all.
Yeah, they told me.
Because your credit score is too low.
Credit score was too low to get a VA loan. Yeah.
And these algorithms, they're supposed to make lending fair. But multiple studies show they often reproduce old biases in new forms. Black borrowers are more likely to be denied conventional mortgages, even when they have the same income, credit scores, and debt-to-income ratios as white borrowers.
That was Will Green with the Hugheses. Now, Ijaz Cecile sits with the three to discuss systemic racism in housing policies, historical exclusion, and the ongoing impact of credit scores on home ownership opportunities for Black communities.
This was a very riveting conversation. I listened when you both were a guest first on Truth Be Told, just the journey of home ownership, the unfortunate experiences that a lot of us as Black Americans are familiar with, you know, even those of us who are not homeowners. But can you sort of tell me what's changed or what has progressed since the last time you were here in terms of where you're at now as homeowners in Orchard Park, is it?
Yes, yes. Yeah. Since we last talked, we did find a house.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But the circumstances was very shady. So the realtor that we were working with, that we had contracted to work with, she just wasn't delivering. She would send us to homes that were just not good homes, still in the same area, still in Orchard Park, but not good homes, not good for us, not good for anybody. She said, well, we'll find another. And so we're seeing homes pop up in our budget. Everything's good. She wouldn't go for them. Then they get snatched up. And so we had gone through this for two, three years?
Almost three years.
Years
that we've been looking. Meanwhile, you know, my credit score is very well. I've really worked on my credit. I worked on debt to income. We sold our cars, traded our cars in, got a one car. So we did the work. You know, we saved our money. Still wasn't happening. And so we knew a friend. She's a mortgage broker. And we told her our situation. And within 6 months,
Actually, I'll pause there. So we told her back in January, and she says she can't do anything until our contract with our previous realtor lapses, which was lapsing in like June or something.
The year before.
So, yeah.
Year before last.
So, no, it was lapsing June of 2025.
Mm-hmm.
So she said, let's talk. July 1st, 2025, let's have a chat.
Mm-hmm.
And July 1st, 2025, she got us a realtor. And we saw a house. Like we saw, like she got us four houses.
Just like that.
Just like that. And we put a bid on one and we didn't get it. And then was it September? Yeah, come to September, the same house, was it September, October?
It was October.
It came back into the market. We went back and saw it. We put a bid on it and we got the house.
Just like that.
Mm. Wow.
Like
just like that. From July to October. Done.
Well, first off, congratulations.
Thank you.
But then also, just reflecting on that experience of this first realtor and why it didn't work out. A lot of times, unfortunately, you can call a bias and see it for exactly what it is, but you can't necessarily call it outright because it's implicit.
Right.
What were you facing during that process that made you feel like we are not getting the treatment we deserved and we think we have a clue as to why?
Well, to be honest, I don't think this individual, because I don't want to be sued, but also I think it's true. I don't think this individual was cognizant of what was happening because we were communicating our discomfort and communicating our needs, but we didn't feel heard. Like some of the things we were talking about was like, we're seeing all these houses, why aren't you throwing houses at us? And she was like, well, you can also send houses to me. But I'm like, you're my realtor. You're supposed to be doing the job. If I could buy a house myself, I wouldn't have needed you. One, two. We also had a problem with the loan,
the mortgage broker
too, who this realtor was working with, who just kept giving us awful like.
There was the algorithm. Okay, there's the algorithm, but there was also debt to income ratio. And once that got sorted out, then he said, okay, the goalposts kept moving. He said, well, your credit score is great, but your debt to income ratio is not good. So once I fixed that, he said, well, it's the algorithm. I said, okay, well, what is it about the algorithm? Well, there's a lot of factors. Which factors? Tell me which factors that I can change so that we can get the mortgage that we need. And he just couldn't give us a straight answer. Then he said the straw that broke the camel's back, for me at least, was when he said, yeah, that credit score is good, but that's not the credit score that we look at. There's another credit score.
Which that was never spoken about ever prior to that. And then that's what I said. I smell a rat here because there's no way. Like, now you have a higher credit score. There's both credit scores have improved and you're getting less money.
Yes. We had less money with the increased credit score than when we started.
Hmm. Like, we're talking about 100 points.
Yes. Like, I got from fair credit to excellent credit. And when I got the excellent credit score, the mortgage that he was offering was $10,000 lower than when we started. And I said, sir, that doesn't make sense to me.
Not at all. As the kids say, the math ain't math.
The math ain't math.
And then also like, but you also don't qualify for a VA loan because your credit score is bad. When has the VA ever been about credit score? So this new mortgage broker, we went to her for pre-approval. She approved us for $90,000 more than that guy was approved. Mm-hmm. I mean, who would you go for?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we went for this person.
She got it done. No problem. There was no issues. The VA kicked in everything. We got it. And in fact, we got it.
Under budget.
We had $10,000 equity in the house from the beginning. No down payment. Everything was good. Closing costs was covered. Like it was a perfect deal for us. The house was turnkey.
As we're having this conversation, Will, I'm kind of seeing the gears turn in your head. I'd love for you to reflect on, you know, hearing their story the first time and then what you're hearing now.
So I think this episode and this interview was probably the best example of how contemporary systemic racism is still impacting us.
Mm-hmm.
Right. There's no denying like what happened with redlining, with what happened with the Homestead Act, where mm-hmm. folks got to get a house and it was guaranteed by the government. You could miss payments. It's still your house, right? And we're talking about laborers who got to own homes, mm-hmm. but Black folks were excluded. GI Bill, Black folks were excluded.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And we still see evidence today where they were trying to purchase a home where even though it may have been taken off the books in terms of how to enforce these policies and strategies, you still had people enacting those rules behind the scenes.
Right.
And hearing this today, this is probably the episode that made me the most angry. because hearing these things today, it's almost as if the process is baked into it to appear innocuous.
Yes.
But when we look at those indicators, they are all negative for black folks. And now here's another thing too, okay? At one point in time in history, as we had gotten out of slavery and had an opportunity to build up our own communities, we were at the top of the mark in terms of a marriage and taking care of kids. And if there wasn't a credit score then, but we probably had it, you know, we would have had it. So when we had the opportunity, these systems didn't exist. And now that all the things that have happened to black communities to put us in these negative positions, so we don't have access to that historical capital.
Right.
So we, our first generation college goers, it impacts us negatively because they say, oh, well, now you can play by the rules.
But you see, that's, let me piggyback on that because I didn't finish my thought process before you asked the question. The thing is this. Why can't we have more black people saying, we have worked so hard to get this house. Why can't you see this as a plus for us? Instead of seeing these children who are born with a silver spoon, you're giving them more opportunities. But here I am, who has worked so hard. His first, your first generation college guy, PhD, earning a lot of money, but he couldn't get a house. Why can't they see this as, if somebody has come up this far and pulled themselves through the bootstraps or whatever you call them. Why can't you change the algorithm to reflect if a black person has gone to college, built their credit score? Why can't that be a plus? Yes.
Why isn't that a factor? Okay, yeah, poor credit, but here they've demonstrated an ability to improve that credit in a short amount of time. Right? We're talking about a short amount of time. We improved all those things.
Well, what I would say to that is, you know, and I'm not going to indict anyone, but what I'll say is I don't often see rules changed in favor of black and brown folks. Yes.
Doesn't happen.
Even to make it equitable.
Right.
But right now we are witnessing rules being changed to make things more difficult for black and brown folks.
Yes.
Now you do with that what you will. I got a name for it, but I say it.
Well,
here.
I mean, and I did a little research because I couldn't sleep at night because I'm thinking this is something is wrong here. I did some research. Did you know that the credit score was invented in the seventies? They invented it in the 70s. And it's interesting that the time that they invented the credit score was the same time that the government thought to experiment with the black middle class. This was when the black middle class was created, because we all know that the black middle class was created. They literally said, let's see what happens if we give these black people money, if we give these black people some kind of access, let's see what they'll do with it. And the moment they did that, affirmative action came out, all these things, guess what? Now there's a credit score. And now that credit score determines whether you are eligible to buy a home, whether you're eligible to buy property. What's the biggest, what's the most reliable and easiest way to build wealth in America is owning property.
Right.
Right. And so there is a correlation there. They move the goalposts. Once they let us in, we get a foot in the door. Then they say, well, that's the wrong door now. Now you got to go through that door.
Stories help preserve history, culture, and community, especially in places where voices and experiences have often been overlooked or excluded. To finish off, Truth Be Told explores the lasting impact of redlining, economic inequality, and the racial wealth gap, while also highlighting the importance of Black-owned spaces and businesses that continue to preserve culture, knowledge, and legacy within the community, with Sharon and Kenneth Holly of Zawadi Books.
My uncle had a dry cleaning business, you know, so he had his own independent business. And these businesses catered to the black community.
Right.
You know, and they provided the services that were needed, you know, for the black community. But when you come north, you would think, well, all that's over. You know, it's very different. But when you get here, you look around and you see, well, it's different, but it's still the same. You know, it's not as overt, but it's there.
Right.
You know. So it's like, stay in your place, you know, you can do this, but you can't do that. You can go here, but you can't go there. You can live here, but we don't want you living there. So it's the same kind of thing, but it wasn't the great big sign.
Right.
You know, it wasn't colored water, white water when you got up here. It was just a fountain that you know you better not drink from,
right.
even mm-hmm. though the sign was missing.
These experiences sit inside a much larger pattern researchers call the racial wealth gap. Generations of exclusion, from slavery to redlining, blocked families from building assets that could be passed on. And while Black-owned businesses grew significantly in the last 5 years, they still make up just 3% of all U.S. firms in a country that is 14% Black. Today's inequalities aren't accidental, they're inherited. In Buffalo, the legacy is visible too. A 2021 study found that Black households in Buffalo held a median income less than half that of white households, a direct outcome of redlining and mid-century disinvestment. Zawadi Books is one of the exceptions, and part of that long lineage. For the Hollies, legacy began with the gift of books, the fight for knowledge, and the desire to create a space where Black stories were centered, not erased.
That was Will Green with the Hollies. Now, What's Next contributor Akua Menzedu sits with the three to discuss their legacy and storytelling, culture, and community.
So I want to talk about this origin story, but also a celebration of 50 years of being bookstore owners. You talked about 50 years of marriage. So give us a little bit of background about how you got here.
Well, basically, we started in 1976. And in 1976, we were married. And out of that marriage came, we started collecting books. And we were just doing events at the time out of a house. So we go to things like Juneteenth and things like that. And that's the way we really began. And then we just finally moved into a bookstore. And we have moved around four times since then. But basically what we have done in terms of legacy is we brought our three daughters up in the business, and all our family and our grandchildren, all of them involved in the bookstore business at one time or another. And all of them right now, most of them are working in community service, which I served 25 years in too. So it is a real legacy in our family.
That's beautiful.
And from the bookstore too, I just want to say when it started out, we were Harambe Books.
Okay.
When we started out, and we eventually sold Harambe Books, and then later decided, oh no, we really like the book business. So we came back as Zawadi Books, which we are today.
That's awesome. And so Will, you moderated this story and conversation. What large takeaways do you have from meeting the Hollies?
Oh man, I mean, well, you talked 50 years of marriage, business ownership around books, which is a story. And I'm like, I think this is probably one of the most fantastic love stories I ever mm-hmm. heard. Mm-hmm. Like, first of all, Black love is a thing to be celebrated, but to hear about how they met, how it developed over this love of reading, and to see where they are now, really stalwarts in the community, a legacy to be cherished. And I did not know that y'all were Harambe Books. I bought books from y'all then too.
Can you share a moment when you realized the impact of your work went beyond what you imagined?
Family, everybody from my mother to our children and to our grandchildren, we was get them all involved. Then we really had a community family too, a group of people we called family, who were like aunts and uncles to our children. And all of us came together and we formed things like the Kwanzaa Committee. We had the Marcus Garvey Day Committee. We had Malcolm X Day Committee. And all these things came out of the bookstore. And all these different people, they all were instrumental, bringing them along with us, because we couldn't have done it without doing it. In other words, if we were working like 12, 13 hours a day on one or the other, it would have been impossible. We didn't have our children involved and our mother wasn't there to babysit, our mothers and fathers wasn't there, their sisters. We couldn't have done it without that legacy and building on it too, so our children can continue it and maybe their children can continue it too.
And I'd also add to that we both had a love of literature, mm-hmm. a love of reading, a love of books, especially promoting African and African-American writers, you know, just the information involved. And so it was really like how to share that information with the community, with other people, how to help them find the books that, you know, about our history that would help them grow as well.
I love that. And so, Will, you know, when I listened to their podcast, the generational bridge is something that continued to come up, and they just mentioned bringing their family into it. How do you think that this looks in terms of passing this work down in these values onto the next generation?
It was critical. It's critical. And they even mentioned that legacy piece was nothing without family being involved. And then to bring community in, I guess the most important thing is, we got the internet, we got AI, right? You have all that information, but we're talking about information that you can't access anywhere when you talk about Zawadi books. So there has to be a space for those voices that don't get the airplay, are not in traditional forms of media, but Zawadi books kind of holds that knowledge. And it's important for young people to know what that history looks like so we don't repeat those mistakes of the past.
Right. And so when we think about oral tradition and literacy, you both talked about how literacy and oral tradition go together in terms of preserving Black history and culture. What does that look like in real time?
Well, for me, I'm also a storyteller. And so I see the obligation to pass down the stories, not only of our history, but of things that are going on presently, so that a lot of the literature I find, I'm able to use it in storytelling to adapt it to different age groups so that they will get the story that they might not be reading or might not be learning in another situation. So I'm able to use the skills of a storyteller to try to talk about that history.
Awesome. And so when you think about literacy, and that's a conversation that we've had more and more recently, literacy levels are lower, right? Mm-hmm. But the importance of being able to read and understand where you come from is paramount.
Exactly.
And basically, too, we got to remember that when we was growing up, reading was brought to us as an enjoyment. In other words, we read for fun, besides for information. Sometimes our children, especially our grandchildren, don't see reading like that. In other words, they'd rather be on these games. And reading is like a drudgery. Mm-hmm. You know, something they only connect reading with school.
Right.
Whereas we didn't connect reading with school at all. You know, a lot of times we connected reading with enjoyment. You know, we could pick up a good book and read a good story. You know, that had nothing to do with school except the fact that we learned how to read there. But it's a completely different thing when you look at reading like that. We look at reading as something as a pleasure, not just a drudgery that somebody made you do, or like it's a homework assignment.
Right, right. And so, Will, when you think about your own personal reflection, right, in this 12-part series, how has working on the series shifted how you think about legacy?
I don't think it has shifted it. I mean, I was grateful to hear these detailed stories like the Hollies, how they met, the love of books, literature, reading, the importance of that type of legacy for the Black community. Like it was wonderful to hear everyone share their stories, the tragedies and the triumphs. But it has not, you know, if anything, it strengthened my resolve. Ms. Holly just used the word obligation, right? Mr. Holly talked about competing priorities. There are all these other things that you could be doing, but for me, it is an obligation to learn about our people as best I can so I can push forward the things that I've learned to help us in this struggle against oppression, disenfranchisement, and all the other things that we see firsthand in Buffalo.
Absolutely. And so one of the last questions that I want to ask is to the Hollies, when people interact with your work, whether it's through your bookstore, a story, the podcast, what do you hope stays with them?
I hope what stays with them when I interact with people is that they see a future in what we're trying to preserve and what we're trying to do. So I'm aware of the fact that we won't live forever, you know, but I'm hoping that someone who sees the work that we've done will be inspired to continue that work, even though it might take a different turn or it might look like a different setting. I hope that the inspiration is there to say, wow, this work was useful. This was needed. Let me find a way to try to continue that.
Yeah, I just hope that they see that it was a connection between us, not just us two, but our family. and that encourages others to bring their families in and see, not only get to see about the work, but see the enjoyment it brings with interacting with your family that way, and your work and your family, and bringing in the community. It all comes together, you know, and it's not just one thing. It's a multitude of things that help you bring this message forth to the community.
We've reflected on conversations centered around health, education, home ownership, legacy, and the realities that continue to shape communities here in Buffalo and across the country. More importantly, these conversations remind us why spaces for honesty, storytelling, and community dialogue matter. We thank Will Green, the team behind Truth Be Told, and all the guests and voices who contribute to these important discussions. As we continue reflecting on the impact of May 14th, may we also continue the work of listening, learning, supporting one another, and building a stronger future together. For What's Next, I'm executive producer Charles Gilbert. Thank you for listening.
Support for the BTPM NPR What's Next podcast comes from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, partnering with the community to pursue racial and socioeconomic health equity. Learn more at hfwcny.org.